Time now for the Weekly Word with the Professor Stephen Hines and myself, Jason Spies. This week, we're being joined by Greg Walker. Greg Walker is one of the country's most recognized and respected leaders in natural resource policy. He is the author of Smoking Them Out, The Theft of the Environment and How to Take It Back, which is now in its second printing. He also writes a weekly newspaper column on natural resource issues and publishes a blog called Resources and Reality, with several thousand subscribers nationwide. He is the president of the Natural Resources Group, a consulting firm specializing in energy, water, public lands, mining, forestry, and wildlife. He serves on the Board of Energy and Environmental Legal Institute, the Policy Advisory Board of the Heartland Institute, and is a Centennial Institute Fellow at Colorado Christian University. Walker spent a decade on Capitol Hill, served in the governor's cabinet as secretary of the Colorado Department of Natural Resources, and was president of the National Organization of Natural Resources Cabinet Secretaries. And now, of course, we're being joined with the Professor Stephen Hines and Mr. Greg Walker himself. And I appreciate you joining us this week to talk about a few things energy related and whatnot. And one of the things we like to do here is, you know, we discuss a little bit of layered issues. We don't necessarily get into the shallow gotcha things. We like to talk about some facts and how that affects people's lives. And we appreciate you coming on with that great mind of yours. So we'll give you a little bit of a free plug, if you don't mind. How do you make a money in the real world? We'll give you a plug for your business, if you don't mind.
I appreciate that, although I don't make a lot of money. It's never been a big part of what motivates me in my life, but I do some consulting work in the natural resources field, and I do an awful lot of writing.
Okay, great. Well, we'll have links at the website, and that's just kind of our way of saying appreciate you taking the time to come on here to talk about some things, because what we talk about is some pretty important issues, and you know, this does affect a lot of people's lives. I'm seeing that you do a lot of things in Colorado when it comes to natural resources. Of course, Colorado, stereotypically known for being one of the greener states, and they have a lot of energy. Do you mind if we just kind of set the table a little bit about with your background? That had to be a fine balance for you, I would imagine, being somebody who is so integrated in the energy industry, but also in a very environmental sound state like Colorado.
Well, I appreciate that, and I am a fifth generation native of Colorado, and I am as green as they get. I refuse to abandon the high ground to anybody else. And in fact, it's one of the things that's always bugged me about environmental issues is the extent to which they have become so divisive and divided and bitter and nasty and contentious. And because I can remember, as you guys probably can too, just a generation or so back when there was virtually universal agreement among Americans on the need to clean up our air and water and to save endangered species and all of that. And we've gone from what used to be universal agreement to this world we're in now, where people can't even sit across the dining room table from each other and talk about these issues because they're too busy suing each other across the courtroom table. And it bothers me. I've known in my life some of the great leaders of the environmental movement. And, you know, those people all live in houses made out of wood and drive cars made out of steel that burn oil. And it just never struck me as obvious that many people could be that out of touch with reality. And I've also known all sorts of people who were leaders in mining and timber and logging and agriculture and water and oil and gas and so on. Those people don't hate nature. In fact, some of the great outdoorsmen I've known in my life were loggers and miners and ranchers and so on. So I've spent a lot of my life just trying to figure out ways to turn down the volume, to get people to understand we all care deeply about the environment. We all feel kind of a moral duty to leave this planet better than we found it. And so that's not what we should be arguing about. We should always be discussing what is the right thing to do for the environment. And unfortunately, it has deteriorated to the point where that isn't usually the gist of the argument. Whether we're talking about endangered species or forest health or energy or clean air and water, it sort of doesn't matter. It's all sorts of side issues that get us off into this tangent us against them, right or wrong, yes or no, cut and dry, black and white, and it's just not that simple.
Well, I really like this this conversation, how it's starting out, because something I've been talking about over the past probably 6 to 9 months that is really picking up a lot of steam and is this religion of environmentalism. And boy, the way that you just spoke really added a whole new layer that I have never really brought to the argument before, which is, you know, when you look back at the universal acceptance of recycling and the environment, you're exactly right, because a lot of people forget the EPA was started by who I like to call the last liberal president we had, Richard Nixon. I mean, Richard Nixon started the EPA. He wanted to do health care. So I kind of do it tongue-in-cheek a little bit, but there is some truth behind it because it was started under him. And even Ron Paul, who is very well known for being a libertarian Republican, has even gone on record to say that there is a need for the EPA. So when you take a look at those two, you know, pretty conservative Republicans saying that, that does bring up your point that there was a time when everybody was on board with, you know, we should recycle, we should have clean waters, we should have clean airs. And what happened was a flip of the switch or a passionate Bronco that got set out of the barn, whatever you want to call it. That's where that religion of environmentalism came into where my argument's been that the protester has become a profession to where now they're paid, so they no longer are passionate about their social cause. They're actually more passionate about making money. And then the other one is that religion of environmentalism thing where we need to save the planet and be on that extreme side of things. So I'm going to let you comment on that, just retort, I guess, to your comment, because I think that, wow, you opened my eyes to a whole new vein of that universal acceptance we had towards, yeah, recycling's a good thing.
Well, I know that the conversation isn't specifically about history, but it is important for people to realize, I think, that this is a fairly recent development. I spent 10 years working on Capitol Hill in the 1980s, working for one of the most arch-conservative senators of all time, Bill Armstrong. And during that era, Armstrong not only sponsored and co-sponsored and helped pass legislation creating national monuments and national parks and even wilderness areas, so did all of the other Republicans from all of the other Western states. What was different then is that there was this bipartisan universal agreement to it. Think about the controversy over national monuments, for example. What has happened that's different, just to lay a 20-second background, all the national monuments and national parks in Colorado all were created by executive orders from presidents using the Antiquities Act, and that's true of almost all national parks in the country that started out that way. What's different is the local communities asked for it, wanted it, lobbied for it. They united, they put together these big campaigns with the Chamber of Commerce and the Rotary Club and the city and the county and the state legislatures, the governor. They asked the president to help preserve these great and beautiful places because it would help the tourism economy and because it helped their quality of life and so on. What happened in the years since Bill Clinton is different than that. These are sneak attacks, surprises from presidents who come in and designate huge national monuments over the objections of the people who live there, specifically for the purpose of stopping the human activity that those communities depend on. That's what's new. That's what's different.
Well, and I'd also like to add something, Greg. It really is a matter of, I think, semantics. I was thinking about the other day when I used to work for a large-scale energy efficiency manufacturer, and I got in the habit of saying conservation, which was, I think, a more accurate term for what we should be talking about. And it got changed into energy and energy efficiency. Now, I adopted and adapted, and I changed, you know, what I said, but I think in some ways, hearkening back to history a little bit does not hurt our discussion, Greg. I mean, frankly, the first person to put anything about national monuments ready was Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's important to realize, because nowadays the issue seems not only divisive but also partisan. In fact, I've seen polls fairly recently where as many as, by margin, as much as 70-30, Americans think Democrats are better for the environment than Republicans. And that seems ironic to me because, as you say, the first reservation of public land in America at Yosemite was signed by Abraham Lincoln, the first Republican president. The first national park at Yellowstone was created by Ulysses Grant. The conservation movement, as we now think of it, is Theodore Roosevelt and all of his friends. But clearly, into the modern era, as we started this conversation at the very beginning with, what we think of now as the cornerstones of environmental law, Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, all of these were initiatives of a Republican administration, and they were shepherded through almost unanimously by a Democrat Congress. These issues were just not partisan until fairly recently.
Well, look,
I was just going to say, I saw your speech in front of the Heritage Club when you announced your book from 2013 called Smoke Them Out. Sorry for the plug for you, Greg. Smoke Them Out, The Theft of the Environment and How to Take It Back. But in your speech in front of the Heritage, you started out by saying that John Muir was a Republican president.
The founder, some of the great founders of the conservation movement, including John Muir, the founder of the Sierra Club, was not only a Republican, but a close friend of Theodore Roosevelt and of congressmen and senators at the time. He was active in politics, and there was, today it seems weird, because today, if you speak to members of the Sierra Club and talk about John Muir being a Republican, they get mad. But history is history. It's a fact.
and the other thing about John Muir, I was rewatching. There's a wonderful American Masters on John Muir. If you've not had a chance to see it, I highly recommend it. But I was rewatching it, and if you really look at John Muir's life up until he got, he got stuck on Hetch Hetchy, which was, if you don't remember that battle, I suspect you do, Greg, but it was a battle over water for San Francisco versus by damming up Hetch Hetchy. When John Muir started really getting political was shortly after his wife died. And in some ways, it put him off the rails, because he really, in a sense, became sort of anti-democratic as he fought for what he thought was right as far as to dam or not to dam Hetch Hetchy.
Well, it's fascinating history. There's a chapter in my book, in fact, about the Hetch Hetchy controversy and the founding of the Sierra Club that resulted from it. And it's kind of ironic in today's world, because particularly in the aftermath of Bruce Babbitt's tenure as Secretary of the Interior, where he wanted to be the first secretary to tear down dams and wanted to remove dams all over the West, the Hetch Hetchy battle, as you well know, John Muir lost, and so the reservoir and the dam were built, and it supplies a large portion of the water supply to San Francisco today. And today, when the liberals, including those in San Francisco, advocate tearing down dams, that's not one of the ones they think about, because that's their water.
Hardly surprising, wouldn't you say? As we take a step back, and the news is coming at us, as both of you know, it's coming at us like a freight train. So you may have heard, Greg, and I think you have, Jason, but the city of Boulder has joined New York and San Francisco in suing the major oil companies for climate change. So it's just the city now, of course, of Boulder. But it makes very interesting reading when you look at the details, because the mayor of Boulder pointed out to the residents that it wouldn't cost Boulder any money, that other people were going to pay for the legal fees. Now, we know who the other people are.
Well, it's the city of Boulder now, but it didn't.
New York and California.
Yeah, it's the city of Boulder now, but it didn't start off that way. It started off with a bunch of attorneys general around the country, particularly in the Northeast, suing ExxonMobil and trying to out all of the contributors to a bunch of nonprofit organizations that sort of question the science behind climate change. And it's a really, it's actually a fairly sinister thing when you think about it. The attempt is to dry up all the contributions to anybody who might question. And it seems ironic to me because I'm not a scientist, I'm not a climate scientist, and so on. But I recognize that the notion of settled science that no longer can be discussed even is an offense against science. True scientists never believe that the science is absolutely settled and there should be no further conversation. And yet, that's sort of the mantra coming from that group. And it just tells you that there's an agenda there that has nothing to do with science.
Well, that brings up the whole religion part of it right there, because religion is settled, whereas science, you're still questioning things. You know, I mean, everybody thought the atom was the smallest thing until they split it open and they found things that were smaller. And that's a really interesting point, actually. And I wanted to ask you about that boulder thing, circling back to that. I hadn't really heard much about that. If you're from Colorado, what's the how's the industry taking that from the 5,000 foot view? I mean, is this something they're ignoring, or is this something they're like, oh boy, this could be a crack in the dam?
Well, I think at least some of them are worried about it, and probably should be, because we have, you know, courts are all over the maps these days, and it's never clear exactly how legal situations like that are going to come out in the end. But here, what they're trying to do is to use RICO kind of prosecutions, the same as they used against the tobacco industry. And it's based on a claim that big oil companies knew about climate change and knew that their activities were causing it and knew that it would hurt the earth to the point where it couldn't support life anymore. 30 years ago, 40 years ago, you know, going way back, same as they did with the tobacco industry, only they're trying to claim that ExxonMobil knew about this, you know, 10 years before the climate scientists even started talking about it. Back in the era when all the scientists thought we were going to have a new ice age, which isn't that long ago, I can remember it when I was in college. And now we're talking about global warming, and they're trying to, and not only to blame it on the use of fossil fuels, that's one thing, and that's a debatable point. But to say that the oil companies knew about this and knew how harmful it would be, purposely hid the science from the public and so on for 30 years is just insane. But that, you know, that's not what it's really about. The real effort is to try to stop, and this is the way it began, with Elliot Spitzer, the attorney general in New York, and a number of others who joined an attorney general association to file these RICO lawsuits and the first thing they did was subpoena all the donation records. What we're trying to do is to stop ExxonMobil and others from contributing money to these nonprofit organizations on the other side of the issue, starting with the Competitive Enterprise Institute and a number of others that are sort of free market think tank types. They're trying to dry up the donations to those organizations. And one of the best ways to do that, of course, would be to with these lawsuits. If they could do that, and if they could figure out a way to take billions of dollars out of oil companies and put them in the hands of the, you know, global environmental industry, they would all be better off for it. We would all not be.
Well, I have a really good quote. The American NGOs, the environmentalists, have now gone off our country into Canada, and they started a suit against the building of a port for liquid natural gas over in Vancouver along the shoreline, and it was taking oil from Alberta. And a group called the 30 Tribes, the first national tribes, came out and opposed what American NGOs were doing, and here's what they had to say. They said, "We absolutely do not support big American environmental NGOs who make their money from opposing natural resource projects, dictating government policy and resource developments within our traditional territories." It can't be any clearer than that. And at the end of the day, you have a group of people who now have really gone too far for me, and that's saying something. because what they the way these NGOs make their money is, as the tribe said, opposing natural resource projects, and I might add, ill-gotten gains from sue and settle lawsuits, government grants, right, healthy foundations, and unsuspecting people.
I should just note as an aside, I don't begrudge these organizations their tactics. They're quite sophisticated at it. They're well-funded, well-organized, and really bright from a tactical point of view. And if you're in the nonprofit world, this is what you do. You can't go around telling the public the problem's been solved, and they won't need you anymore. So you have to say the sky is about to fall, and the world is going to hell in a handbasket. Everyone send money. Nobody writes checks to organizations who have solved the problem and there's no problem anymore. So they will never admit when we have, in fact, cleaned up the air and water way beyond what anyone thought possible 30 years ago, or that we've recovered endangered species, or, you know, whatever the victory is. They'll never declare victory. The sky is always about to fall. So I don't begrudge them that. I just want the people, the public, to understand it so that they'll, you know, so people can be their own judge and understand that there is an agenda at work that is not about cleaning up the environment. And let me just give you an example. I'm not trying to filibuster here, but one of the best examples that we see in the West, whether we're in Colorado or in North Dakota or where, is endangered species. And when you think about what happens, they put new species on the endangered list every time there's a problem of any sort. That's why we have well over 2,000 species on the endangered list now. And we have recovered and taken off the list fewer than one half of 1% ever in the history of the Act. Nobody concentrates on recovering the species, only listing them and then using that as a tool to control habitat. Well, when the argument's all about habitat and not about species, then it's inevitable that the discussion devolves to land use every single time. So the argument is always about whether to close the roads or ban snowmobiles or stop logging or stop oil and gas or stop mining or stop grazing, stop everything. It's everything in the world other than the species. So what we did, and this is really the aha moment for me, in Colorado, we wanted to turn that on its head by actually recovering endangered species so they could be taken off the endangered list. So we built hatchery to raise endangered fish. We started bringing back to the state, reintroducing populations of lynx and desert bighorns and moose and river otters and black-footed ferrets and boreal toads, all sorts of species that were endangered, with tremendous success, by the way. And every step of the way, these big environmental organizations and the federal agencies in charge were absolutely opposed to it. So I'll tell you, in fact, they threatened to bring lawyers and sue us to stop the effort at one point. And I just tell you, when you're doing the right thing for the environment that the public cares about and environmentalists are opposed to it, that's absolute proof that there's some agenda other than the environment at work.
Well, last week, Tom Shepstone from Pennsylvania was saying, because they're involved in an enormous legal battle over the Delaware River Basin, he said, the truth is, the only way to stop this kind of silliness is to beat them in court. And frankly, what I would add, as I was thinking about it the other day, I would add that we should have a provision that the people who lose the suits should pay for all the legal expenses. That would certainly handle a lot of frivolous suits in the process.
We've been down that road for several years, and what happens is the environmentalists get their expenses paid and the other side doesn't, as a rule.
That's what I'm saying is, we end up paying the environmentalists, which is that sue and settle mentality. And
right.
And it seems like it's a one-way street where the taxpayer and the states and the regions and the local community who hope to have better economic development are paying the price for frivolous lawsuits. So somehow there has to be a way of breaking this unholy alliance between legal action and who's using it for frivolous purposes or counter community purposes.
I think it can also be one in the, I don't I don't doubt that we can win some of these kinds of lawsuits. And by we, I don't mean me. I'm not involved in any of them. But I think we can win these arguments in the court of public opinion as well, if people understand what the agenda is and what's going on. And, that, you know, we should be having legitimate debates about water in the West, for example, or about species. You know, if you think that people should stop driving their cars and stop using the energy that this world has so abundantly to heat their homes and to build a comfortable life and so on, that's fine. That's a perfectly legitimate debate. Bring it on. But that debate is not about polar bears. So when they try to use polar bears as the excuse to stop oil and gas drilling, it's a false agenda. The fact is there are more polar bears in north of the Arctic Circle than there have been in 75 years, and the numbers don't lie about that. But polar bears are cute, and you can use that as a tool to get at public opinion. And so my point of view in Colorado always was, if it's about polar bears, then let's make it about that. How many polar bears do you want? Where should they be? How long do they have to continue surviving before we declare them to be recovered and take them off the list? That shouldn't be the argument. If the argument's just about whether we should use energy, let's have that argument.
You know,
there's a new study out by perhaps the preeminent biologist who has been studying the polar bears for 30 years, and their population has increased significantly. So somebody got the idea because they saw a bit of footage of a starving polar bear. They started using it as their poster boy again, and of course within a day or two that whole notion was disproved. Sorry, Jason, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to get back to what Greg was kind of talking about there. He was kind of bringing up that 5,000-foot view a little bit, saying, you know, that they really politicized the argument by, you know, picking these different low-hanging fruits of pulling at the heartstrings. And we experienced that in North Dakota with the DAPL protest. And I've been noticing something for the last 3 years, which is an increased polarization, a political polarization in oil and gas. And I'll give you three examples. One was right there, the DAPL pipeline protest, and I'll get back to that in just a second. Second one is when it comes to, I was in Colorado actually, and I was I spent a lot of time in Colorado, and when I stay at hotels, I like to go down to those breakfast areas and just talk to people. And several times now, people have been kind of looking over their shoulder before they say they work in the oil and gas industry. And they say that because they say that they get publicly shamed for the oil and gas industry. And then the third thing is what you brought up is, you know, the polar bears, but I like to say, well, let's just flick the lights off then and see if they, you know, want to try to live off of solar and wind and a few other things, because I got news for you. If it's not coming from natural gas, coal, or crude oil, it's down to like 5 to 10% of what's left to help power the country. So I did want to ask you about the politicizing of energy. That's where I'm going with all of this. With the DAPL pipeline is where it really showed to me where we still have some issues here in the state with it in terms of political fallout. 25% of the Bakken is under Native American land. We had wounded veterans coming to protest Hollywood. It made it a political thing. To me, my argument has been over the past several years, it seemed like it's become so extreme that when you mention oil and gas, people are coming back or lumping in right to life and abortion issues and gun control and that sort of thing when it comes to big oil. And that really concerns me. Do you understand what I'm saying by that? Am I way off base? Or are you witnessing the same thing?
No, I think you're right on. In fact, part of the problem we have with energy in this country is that it can be found most readily in communities that are supportive, but it has to be transported someplace else to where the population is. And so oil and gas, you need pipelines, and with you can build power plants in communities where they're like that, but you still have to have power lines that go to the cities. So either way, you're going to wind up crossing Forest Service, BLM, National Park Service, you know, local lands and whatever. We see these controversies in The Dominion Pipeline in Virginia, the Keystone Pipeline across the Midwest. DAPL is as good an example as any. And the arguments are just flatly disingenuous. They get people all worried about public safety. But, you know, by a factor of 1,000, pipelines are way safer than trucks going up and down the road filled with oil, including crossing bridges over rivers. And, you know, they want to make it seem like, obviously, the pipe is going to break and the river will be polluted. But, of course, there aren't any examples of that ever happening. So it's a way to get people up in arms and to polarize the issue, as you correctly said. But the reality is, this country, you cannot build a prosperous economy without natural resources. And so the great challenge in our lifetime for natural resources leaders is how to provide the natural resources it takes to build a prosperous economy in ways that we can all be proud of. That's what the debate should always be about, and it just deteriorates into this us against them shouting match that's very, very unhelpful, and in fact, unhelpful to such an extreme. I've said this in a number of speeches where talking about the growth of the environmental movement to the point of success beyond the wildest dreams of John Muir or Aldo Leopold or Rachel Carson or any of the other godfathers of environmentalism, none of them could have envisioned the massive size and strength and power and funding and so on of these organizations. But at the same time they've reached the pinnacle of success in that way, they've also become intellectually bankrupt. And by that I mean they have no answers to these great questions. How do you build a prosperous society without natural resources? Any idiot can stop anything in this country today. The question is, how are you going to supply the resources that it takes then? Because their answer to everything, no matter what it is, if you're talking about air, water, energy, forests, whatever, their answer to everything is stop that. Well, sorry, but stopping everything doesn't help.
Well, Greg, you know, one of the, maybe the classic example of a city or a state that lives in this kind of another region known as hypocrisy is the city of New York. Now, I've lived there 3 times. I love the city, the greatest city in the world as far as I'm concerned. However, they were using number 6 oil up until Mayor Bloomberg, and they started an initiative to bring in natural gas from Pennsylvania, specifically from the Marcellus. So their air and their, say, their ambiance has been improved significantly through their use of natural gas, and yet they won't let pipelines be built, even short pipelines. They won't let pipelines through to New England. And I have to say, watching the governor and the mayor shows just how little they know about the energy issues. One last thought. Today in the New York Times op-ed, there was an argument on behalf of building pipelines for New England. Gasp! I almost passed out when I read that. And it was on the editorial page. But somebody, they simply are acting like gatekeepers for all of New England. They are enjoying the benefits of natural gas. And they, being the city of New York, because they outnumber the countryside about 4-1. So it's really one city that is acting as some kind of a roadblock or tollway for the rest of New England.
Well, I first of all, I love New York also, and some of the nicest people on the planet live there. So it isn't about that, but they are led by, unfortunately, by people with a very, very strong political agenda. In Nanny Bloomberg's case, a desire to bankrupt the coal industry so that people will be required to invest more in natural gas, which he has invested heavily in, by the way, sort of in the same way that T. Boone Pickens tried to get everybody to use natural gas as the stopgap while we build wind all over the country. And, of course, natural gas as the stopgap means buying natural gas from people like him. So I understand their agenda, and but when you get down to it, that's all about money. That has nothing to do with the environment. So I think you ought to just tell people what it is. You know, the truth is the truth, and I like to speak it plainly, and sometimes it gets me into trouble, but that is the reality as I see it.
Going back to what Jason said about going to Colorado and people are sheepishly walking around if they're anywhere near the oil and gas industry while in public, 3 years ago, Mayor, well, I guess he was not mayor at the time, or maybe he was just after he left office. He wrote a piece on fracking and how the state of New York should not prevent fracking. And in fact, when he donated, I think, $60 million to the Sierra Club, and I think he had friends who matched that number, he wrote one provision in his contribution to the Sierra Club that they wouldn't take a anti-natural gas or fracking position. How long do you think it took them to violate that one condition of Mayor Bloomberg's of donation? The other thing I'll notice right now, Mayor Bloomberg has been strangely silent on natural gas pipelines and fracking for the last couple of years, which seems to be in contradistinction to his position 3 years ago.
Well, just check where his investments are and where his personal money is, and you'll understand that just fine.
All right, let's see what we got here. Hang on. I just had to check something real quick on the levels. So, all right. Weekly Word, we got reset here real quick. Greg Walker and the Professor Stephen Hines were talking about some of the energy issues of the day, if you will. And I wanted to get back to the endangered species part of it, because in North Dakota we have that being used as a political piece quite a bit, whether it's the endangered sage grouse or, like I think you said or made assumption of, that a lot of times they're used before they're even put on the list. They're being used by these groups. They're being to halt projects, and then they got a study to see whether it should be on the list or not, and these types of things. Is this finally turning the corner on it with our new administration, or where does the direction of this endangered species? Because, man, that is a tough nut to get by the outer shell on the average person.
It is a very difficult issue, and I've been talking a lot with the new leadership of the Interior Department, and there is some reason to be quite hopeful there. Their movement to delist the lynx, for example, is a great sort of symbol that they're willing to look at what's gone on out there. The repeal, or at least begin repeal of the regulations on sage grouse, is another where the sage grouse is actually a great example of what has gone wrong with that whole process. In Colorado, we spent something like $50 million of state, local, and nonprofit money restoring habitat, purchasing conservation easements to help the sage grouse, and so on, making management deals with all the ranchers and farmers. Virtually every western state, including North Dakota, has done that as well. All of that with the clear understanding that it was in lieu of listing the sage grouse as endangered. And of course, at the end of the day, they went ahead and listed it anyway. So this is with the Gunnison sage grouse. And then the greater sage grouse, which you deal with in North Dakota, they decided against the listing only because they were going to implement regulations that actually would be even worse. And so it just represents to Westerners a gigantic broken promise, not that we have any shortage of those dealing with the federal government, but it just shows you it's very hard to make agreements and make deals with people around a dining room table when they were going to move the goalposts on you the next day. And we see it over and over again over a period of 20 or 30 years. We just kind of get jaded about it. And so the result of that is that kind of enforcement and this kind of argument is not only bad for the economy in communities that are so dependent on public lands, it is demonstrably bad for the environment. And that's where I think we ought to focus the conversation, because most Americans, whether they live in rural communities dependent on public lands or not, all Americans care about the environment. And if they realize that the federal top-down command and control approach has destroyed the national forests in this country and squandered much of the conservation legacy and is bad for endangered species and so on, I think they'll start to wake up and say we need a different approach.
I kind of chuckle because, you know, when you look at some of the innovation behind these well pads, You know, I've talked to many of these guys, and it actually protects, like, the native flora, for example. And some of the innovations that have come from the oil and gas industry over the past 20 years are remarkable with reclamation and environment. And then I laugh because we're still cleaning up the DAPL pipeline protest from those environmentalists. I mean, here you got the environmentalists causing more damage behind, and here you got the environment, you got the oil and gas being almost silent environmentalists. Greg, do you know what I'm talking about?
I do, and we see it in every state. As I said before, DAPL is a great example of it, but it's everywhere you look. And it's especially true, I think, in the West, and it's one of the reasons that the issues are so difficult to solve at a national level, because people in the East don't have to deal with it, because the federal government doesn't own all the land and all the resources east of the Mississippi like it does in the Western states. And so you have this this completely different approach to everything from particularly water, and water law that's so different out west, but also the management of all the lands and all the resources in, you know, in Virginia and Maryland and all the Washington, D.C. surrounding area. No one has to deal with the BLM or the Forest Service every time they want to do anything. That's something that's unique in the West. And so it creates a kind of a different approach that people out, you know, I remember this argument I had years ago with a guy on Capitol Hill from Rhode Island who was telling me the importance of setting aside massive section of our state as a wilderness area, a section way bigger than his entire state, by the way. And we couldn't convince him that it would be bad for the economy. He didn't care about that. We couldn't convince him that the people out there should be consulted because these are lands that belong to all the people, which he rightly pointed out. Finally, we got so frustrated, we get to the point of asking him, have you ever even been there? And I'll never forget his response to it, which was, I don't need to go there to know how beautiful it is. For me, it's enough just to know that it's there. And, you know, it's fascinating because for the people who live there, of course, it isn't enough just to know that it's there. Life depends on the use of public lands in the West. When the government owns all the resources, you do business on public lands or you're out of business. And so it's we've got to convince people that there's a different need in places like that. And say they've created instead this concept that if you let local people be in charge of the resources, they'll destroy them. And of course, to Westerners, there's nothing more offensive than that. Nobody cares more about my backyard than I do.
Well, there's a wonderful line from a former senator from Montana, which I always loved. He said, you know, other than California, there's an awful lot of dust between light bulbs out here. So you have a less densely populated area. And for any number of reasons, the government owns, what, 35% of all lands west of the Mississippi, I think, Craig?
Yeah, that's right. And in some states, in Nevada, it's almost 97%.
Well, and you're going to love this. This is really, to me, this is the height of, I don't know, I'll let you put a word on it. Today, the state of Washington announced that they're going to ban fracking. Now, and Oregon is followed suit. Now, you might ask, do they have anything to frack? No, they don't. But it's a symbolic act, I guess, is the way they look at it. Of course, it's always easy to do something symbolic if it doesn't cost you votes or money.
Yeah, well, that's right. If they don't want any energy production in the state of Washington, I guess the people who live there have that right. It's not what I want in my state.
They don't have any, Greg.
Yeah, I get that.
Hmm. Wow. Boy, that's interesting. Just that just seems like wasted resources. They could be probably tackling issues that are actually current in the state. It seems like inventing a problem so they can create a solution. Wow, it's I didn't realize that.
The sky is falling. Send money.
Well, that's right.
I have a friend who does lobbying. And he's a liberal Democrat, God bless him, good man. He's been lobbying for a firm who's trying to build a port out in Oregon. Now, the port is supposed to be able, is designed to liquefy and ship liquid natural gas. They continue to fight. Every time they get a yard, they lose two. They've been working on it for 7 or 8 years, trying to get you know, the proper approvals from the state, et cetera, et cetera. And I think if you look at a strategy, and you're going back to what you were saying, Greg, you know, you have to give it to them because they've done it. What one of the strategies that has worked best of all is if you make it take too long, nobody can afford to see it through to the end.
Yeah, well, I've consulted the four most brilliant climate scientists on the planet, namely Al Gore, Prince Charles, Leonardo DiCaprio, and Matt Damon, all of whom say that that we are destroying the Earth's capacity to support life. And here's the great irony: if you really believe that, and if you really believe, for example, that greenhouse gases, especially methane, are destroying the capacity to support life on this planet, then you'd go after with a vengeance every single thing that generates methane, and particularly if you believed that the largest source of methane on the planet is cattle, then why would you ban cattle? And yet not one time have any of those four ever proposed banning cows. They know the public wouldn't support that, and they all like to eat their steak. So this is just another great irony that proves the agenda is something other than the environment.
By the way, California has started the process of monitoring and reducing methane from cows. Now, when I saw that, I think it's maybe 7 or 8 months ago, maybe a year ago, that they have begun the process of measuring and quarantining cows raised in California. I guess I should really talk to the dairy industry to see if what they think about it.
Think about what that means, though. They're not stopping cows from doing what cows do. That isn't physically possible. There's no technology to make cows stop eating and passing gas. So what they're really talking about is either limiting the number of cows or what Al Gore proposes, which is taxing farmers. Okay, that's not about. And this is a proposal that's in a number of state legislatures and in other countries like New Zealand, a proposal that would say, let's levy a tax of $200 per cow on every rancher that has more than 100 cows, or whatever, there are various versions of that. Okay, if you did that, would that have any real effect on the environment? Of course not. Cows don't have any way of knowing if their owner has paid this tax or not. So what really would happen is either there would be fewer cows and therefore a more expensive food supply, we'd wind up importing our food from other countries like we do our energy, or the number of cows would stay the same and government's revenue would go up. None of those scenarios have the slightest thing to do with the environment. They're all about money.
I actually kind of chuckle because in your scenario, I see if the rancher is able to succeed, yes, the government grows bigger, and then they have to actually add somebody to oversee that. So they have to get an office that operates a light and computers. So actually, they're increasing their energy. So they're actually going reverse on it. And the other side of it is, if it doesn't go as well, then poor communities like Greeley are going to really suffer. You know.
Well, but if you go out there and propose in the public that Greeley stopped producing livestock and therefore you can't buy hamburger anymore, or if you do, it's going to be 10 times the price, you'd have a revolution on your hands. So that's not what they're proposing at all. They're just using it as a way to convince people that the sky is falling and therefore we have to regulate more and everybody send money.
Boy, I tell you, and it kind of circles back to what I remember, one of your original points I wrote down, you know, kind of the using fear, basically, fear-based thing. It's not what you said earlier. I think you used kind of almost the word evil was involved, a manipulative type thing where they're basically bleeding a lot of the companies so that they can't do any more research towards things. I mentioned it earlier where, man, that's a whole new level of Machiavellian type of behavior. You know, you start bleeding somebody's resources so they can't investigate further some corrupt science, etc. Man, that's like a whole new level of playing politics.
Well, I think they should just be honest about the agenda. I don't use the word evil, but I use the word dishonest a lot.
Well, another thing, actually, when I hear that, you know, Bjorn Lomborg, well-known internationally, has written extensively on how silly most of this is. Although, when he was pressed for a solution, he couldn't come up with anything better than spending more money, federal money, on research and development. Now, I start thinking about, oh no, not another government agency, one. And I'm thinking, two, what does he think that the private sector is doing right now? While we're speaking, they are spending billions and billions and billions of dollars with millions of people doing research that will benefit all of mankind down the road, and yet they get vilified at the same time. What's wrong with that picture?
I wish people would just think about the reality that the smartest scientists who know the most about energy in the world are the ones who work for the energy companies and not the ones who work for government. And yet,
well, and not the ones who work for university, Greg. University, you get a grant. So universities and employees for universities, they get government money to do this. But if you don't get money off the public sector one way or another, you simply are being underpaid. And anybody who is underpaid for long will probably look for a conscientious company who believes in conservation and is willing to pay what I'm worth.
Well,
that's right. And the academics who work on government grants, of course, really are government employees. It's just a kind of a dishonest way to keep it under the table.
No, couldn't agree more.
Advocating full disclosure for the last 2 years, Greg. Full disclosure from everybody. I want to know what agencies are giving money to whom and who's using it, what grants, and anytime a study is released, tell us where it came from, who financed it, and what's your source of information. For all. Not just the private sector, which is another one of those, one-sided things. It's a one-hand clapping thing. It just seems wrong.
Most of the studies would meet that criteria just fine, and most of them put the logo of the government agency who funded it right on the front cover with the university. It's a joint project, and you can tell where the grant came from, and they're heavily footnoted, so all of the sources are well-cited, but of course what they're citing is each other. So every time there's another grant, then there's another bunch of college professors whose work can be cited in footnotes in the next study, and it just becomes this big, giant cycle that feeds off itself.
If you look at the Clean Power Plan, and I've read it twice, each of the three iterations, there are so many black holes in the Clean Power Plan where they won't release where they got the data from. In some cases, they got it from a study done by Harvard in the 1990s, but they won't disclose it. I mean, I can't think of a program or an idea by the government that was so held back from anybody, including other than the environmentalists who helped write all three iterations. But what I'm really talking about now is I also want to know the money. I think we all need to know how much. I mean, for example, when EPA wanted to, announce the Clean Power Plan, they did a cost-benefit analysis the first time, and all I could find was $8 billion in value, and they got it by saying that pregnant women who ate fish from Lake Michigan would become ill, and so would their children. So they hired Harvard and Syracuse, and they wrote a new what they called indirect health benefits study. And in that study, it matched what the EPA wanted. I'm sure you're shocked that there's some study bias. And then, to do it matters worse, Harvard and Syracuse said, we don't have any horse in this race. Well, as we found out, thanks to a couple of energy and environmental legal institute, we find out that those professors received $43 million. And we wouldn't have found that out without the Freedom of Information Act. And not only...
Yeah, I'm a little more worried about the next iteration of the Clean Power Plan. The Clean Power Plan, as it was issued by the Obama administration, was a clear overreach outside the scope of the legal authority, and the courts have made that clear when they withdrew it. But at some point, they're going to have to visit it again because of the underlying premise that's my bigger concern, which is referred to by insiders as the endangerment finding. Essentially, when the EPA made a finding that carbon dioxide is a pollutant, then the law requires it to be regulated. You can't announce that something is a harmful pollutant and then not regulate it under the Clean Air Act. So they've withdrawn the Clean Power Plan, they've withdrawn from the Paris Accords, but that underlying endangerment finding, which dated from the beginning of the Obama years, is still in place, and either it needs to be revisited, or at some point some court is going to order them to issue a new Clean Power Plan and explain how they're going to regulate carbon dioxide. So I think they're going to have to get back to that original finding and try to figure out what to do about a naturally occurring gas that is beneficial all over the planet being declared a pollutant.
Oh, wow, that's something to keep an eye on for sure. Here we are. We got Greg Walker, the Weekly Word, Professor Stephen Hines, Jason Spies. We're wrapping up here. I'm looking at the times, and we should probably get in our final comments here and a few closing arguments or statements, if you will. And I wrote down a couple notes here. Greg, you'll find this pretty interesting, I believe, based on kind of some of the things we've been talking about today. When I first got into oil and gas reporting and journalism, I'm actually more of a method journalist. And so I went out and lived in the oil patch for a year. And I operated a food truck, and I had Senator Mike Enzi stop by. And I did my live radio show from my food truck, and I wrote a column for the local newspaper. And, you know, I kind of joked because I was out there before the internet came in the Bakken, and so my food truck was the social media, if you will. And so it was way before its time. But what I found out by embedding myself into a community like an oil and gas community was that the locals, they control those oil companies. Now, the oil companies, yeah, they pay the bills and they have all the money. But I found out very quickly that the oil companies understand and respect that their workers are the ones that are making their natural resources dreams come true. And they're the ones that have to go to church every day with the local people that work at the pizza shop and in the haircut place. So the whole operation of capitalism was just magnified beyond belief in my eyes. I was just like, I always joke, I was on entrepreneur overload out there, because during the early days of the Bakken, everything was needed everywhere and this and that. And so I went out there, like I said, and I embedded myself thinking that I was going to do a lot more investigative type stories on oil and gas, meaning that, you know, they were the big bad wolf, if you will. Well, when I got out there, it was just the opposite. The media was picking on them left and right, and some of the national and narrative switch that was happening, I was getting appalled. I went to an oil and gas annual meeting, and the next day I read in the statewide newspaper a completely different recount than what I was. So I wrote a retort. It got picked up nationally, this and that. One of the people from Whiting actually called me to thank me. He said that was the first time anybody in the media has ever done that. I said, I didn't do it for you. I did it for journalism. I did it for truth. I did it for... So my vein went down the path of innovation and the community side of things, because that story really needed to be told in my eyes. And so when I hear you talking about, you know, the local control, I just wanted to point that out, that I wanted to validate your comment of the local control, that I experienced it on a firsthand basis. And yeah, the oil and gas companies might have the money and they might operate the monies, but they also understand if they don't donate to the local kids' soccer game and everything else, and oil and gas, they don't like to brag. They like to be as far under the radar as possible, but they're going to make sure you got a community center so your kids can have weddings and graduations and other things along those lines. Have you been around the oil and gas industry? Do you disagree? Do you agree with my experiences?
I couldn't agree with you more if you were twice as right. The oil companies are not inanimate objects. They're not distant machines of some kind. Companies are people. They're made up of people. And your example is a classic proof of why management and decision-making at a local level will always be better than the top-down command and control approach from Washington, which has never worked and demonstrably doesn't work now. Precisely because people who work locally have to walk down Main Street the next day. They have to face each other. They have, their kids are in the Little League together, and they go to the Kiwanis Club together. That is the reason why they will never destroy the greatness of America if left to their own devices, which is one of the great myths of the environmental movement. Local people not only can be trusted, they can be trusted to do a way better job. I grew up in the peach orchards in western Colorado, and I've dealt with the federal regulators up close and personal, EPA regulators in my orchard and so on. So I also know kind of what it's like out there on the ground. And there's nothing about the federal approach that works, and that works well as it was intended and designed to do. So that doesn't mean that we don't need regulation. It doesn't mean that nobody should pay attention and make sure everyone is doing the job correctly. Obviously, we need that. But it'll come out a lot better if it's in the hands of people who we know care about the environment, rather than this big international global crowd that's pushing an agenda that's all about money and power and control. So I want the agenda to be about the environment. I want us all to do the right thing for the environment, and I don't think it's that hard to do.
Well, I'm going to start singing Kumbaya almost right now. I used to work in Wall Street, guys. I think I've told you this, Jason, for about 4 years. And they had a saying on Wall Street: your assets walk out the front door every night. And that couldn't be more true when it comes to a more a democratic approach to all of these things. One of the reasons I don't like the Clean Power Plan, Greg, is it federalized everything, as did the water, of America. So I really believe that these decisions, energy, water, should still be in the hands of the states and the localities. They know much more than anybody in an ivory tower out in Washington, D.C.
Particularly about water. It's good that you mentioned that. I mean, water is such a different issue in the West in particular because of the arid nature of all of those states. And, of course, if you can't take water out of the rivers and put it to beneficial use, you can't live there. It's as simple as that. And they'll never understand that in places like Washington, where there is, the people think I'm making this up, there's more water in the Potomac River inside the Beltway than in the entire 1,000-mile reach of the Colorado River and all its tributaries. And so people in Washington will just never understand what water is about out west.
Wow. And we have 15,000 lakes in Wisconsin, Greg, so in some ways, and I live on Lake Michigan, so I guess you could say 15,000 lakes and two Great Lakes. But so it is, you know, when I talk to people and I try to say, if you want to know how this all works well, go to North Dakota. Why? Because it's been doing it the longest. It has the machinery for change. It has people like really good companies acting well, and it has people like Greg, not Greg, but Jason, and other people who understand that this is a cooperative process. This is not top down, as you were saying. It just isn't. It will never work. It's undemocratic. And I wish people would stop trying to federalize these issues.
Well, I think we're going to wrap her up on that. And I'd like to have Greg back for a water talk because, you know, in the Bakken, there's two state officials now that have come out and said that they believe probably something like 20 times the amount of water is going to be needed in the Bakken than originally expected. We have another issue happening in the state with where the state flooded Lake Sakakawea in order to do a hydro dam, and the Army Corps of Engineers purchased the surface rights but not the mineral rights, and now the state is trying to go back and sue the landowners to get the mineral rights after the oil company's been paying the landowners for 20 years now. And then the other one is the EPA, what you talked about, the water issues, where that's a huge issue up here in the West, where, you know, this with ranchers, you know, that means every single slough, every cattle watering hole is controlled by the federal government. So I'd love to have you back to talk about water. I bet we could go a full hour on that.
I would love to do an entire show on Western water. It would be a great privilege to do that. I really appreciate the approach that you take to these issues too, Jason, because we really do need to get away from the sort of partisan political arguments and talk about the big picture of the way we care about the environment and the way we ought to approach conservation issues. So it's been a great pleasure chatting with you.